This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help bringing out the best in your pet's behavior, we are here to help. So give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll have another great topic to share. And what is it this time, Patricia?
Today, we'll look at a study about memory loss and aging that was developed for animals but could help us understand memory in humans.
Good. And we'll also welcome a noted scientist to talk about her groundbreaking work with an African gray parrot named Alex, who proved that the species is far more intelligent than previously thought. That's still ahead this hour, but first, let's take a call at 1-800-462-7413. Here's a caller online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hey there. This is Lauren from Plano, Texas. How are you guys doing today?
Well, just great. How are you doing, Lauren?
I am fantastic. Thank you.
How can we help you today?
Well, I have a strange question, or maybe sort of a request. I've always been curious as to the nature of cats and their ability to purr, and I seem to have a similar ability, which is very strange.
I want to hear it.
Okay, maybe, hopefully it'll come through on the phone.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the sound a cat makes when it's looking at a bird.
Yes.
No, it's not?
No.
That's what Frosty sounded like when she was looking.
Well, that's the, you know, that when they're looking at a bird, they have this little chatter sound.
Mm-hmm.
Right? More like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Give us that again, Lauren.
Do it again.
Okay, sure.
Wow, that sounds like a combination between a cat purring and somebody crinkling paper. That's amazing. Is there some career you could come up with?
You know, I wish I could do like a talk show circuit. That would be fantastic. But I don't know how I do it exactly, and I don't know how cats do it. I was wondering if you guys could give me any insight into that.
You know, people didn't know how cats purred. It's been a mystery for centuries and centuries. And last I heard, someone thought they had finally figured it out. There was a big controversy. Did it involve their vocal cords, or did it involve different areas of their body and their esophagus? And the last I heard, if I remember correctly, is that it does indeed involve some kind of manipulation of their vocal cords and airflow.
That makes sense.
It makes sense. Right. Now, Larry, can you purr?
No, I'm not. I'm not any good at. When I hear you trill, I'm old. Yeah, see, I love that. I can't do that.
But I can't purr. But I think we should have you on whenever we have a cat question, is I could trill, and you could purr, and Larry could, sing the Star Spangled Banner.
How did you come to learn that you had this secret ability, Lauren?
I've always had cats, actually. My family, I've grown up with cats. We've always had animals, and predominantly cats. We have four right now, actually. And I guess one day I was sort of talking to my cats and, just meowing at them and cuddling, as it were. And I did sort of the same thing. I just passed some air over my vocal cords. At least that's what it felt like. And this purring sound came out. And my cat sort of looked at me and said, oh, my God, it's a big hairless cat.
That was going to be my question, is how do your cats respond to it? What do they do when you do it?
Actually, they react, they rub their scent glands, the ones behind their ears, they rub those against me, they rub against me, they purr back at me.
Mm, I love it.
And it's actually more fascinating to go into pet shops and things like that, or, to breeders, and go up to a cage full of kittens, because if I do that, then they all immediately come to the bars, and they start meowing, and they start purring, and it's an absolutely fun reaction.
If you have time, you should volunteer at a shelter. No kidding.
That would be fantastic.
I mean, no kidding, because that's being able to communicate in a way that an animal understands. It really is a gift, and it's so stressful for so many cats in shelters. I can just imagine you sort of like Johnny Appleseed going around the country calming cats all over the country. I have a career for you.
Oh, that would be fantastic. I would love it.
Love it. Well, thank you so much for calling. You're our
Absolutely.
First human purr-er.
I think you're right.
That's hard to say,
right.
Purr-er.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, we heard from Doreen in Madison, Wisconsin, and she and her husband are moving into a retirement home, which will finally allow them the time and the space for pets. and they want to adopt a German Shepherd puppy as well as a kitten. The kitten would be an indoor pet, and the dog would have the run of Doreen's one-acre lot in their new retirement home. Doreen wants to know, is it better to get both pets at the same time, or should one of the animals be brought in before the other?
It's a good question, and it partly depends on you. Getting a puppy and a kitten at the same time is a little bit like having, I don't know, triplets. I shouldn't say that. I've never had triplets, but it's a lot of work to raise a puppy, and it's a lot of work to raise a kitten. Now, there's great fun in that they can play together, but they also have to learn how to play together correctly. You know, one of the things that shepherds love to do is chase. That's, you know, that's what they do. And you don't want your shepherd chasing the kitten. So there's a disadvantage in that, one, there's a potential for inappropriate play, and two, the main one is it's a lot of work. And particularly with a kitten, I think it's easy to forget because cats can be so much easier to care for when they're adults than dogs are. But as kittens can get in a lot of trouble. So that's one big consideration. The advantage is that they can grow up as best buddies.
Yeah. And that's a good, big advantage.
Which can be a great advantage. It really, really can. So it's a very personal decision to make.
I'll tell you, they're moving into a retirement home, which means they're retiring, so they probably have the time.
But you're retired, and you're working harder now than you used to. All these people I know who are retired say they don't know how they had time to work because they're so busy. So that's something else to think about. Well, good luck, whatever you decide.
If it was me, if I was going to get one first, I might get the cat first.
Why is that?
Because the German Shepherd does like to chase, and I think if you had an older cat, the cat would be able to maybe teach the puppy, don't chase
me. Little rules. And, you know, that's not a bad idea. And here's another idea. What about a kitten and rescuing an older German Shepherd who needs rescuing?
Idea.
You know, there are a lot of German Shepherd rescue groups around the country. Some of them are really good, and there are a lot of adult dogs out there that need homes. So maybe that's a possibility.
Yeah. And if anybody else wants to email us a question, how do they do that?
We'd love to hear from you. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you want to talk to us in person, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Laura from Virginia Beach. And I have two dogs, both adopted from the SPCA. One is dominant and the other is non-dominant. And my question is, when I take them to the dog park, there are occasions with my dominant dog where there's some trigger with another dog where a brief tussle takes place, and it sounds like they're fighting, but there's never any injuries. And I always get in the middle of these scuffles within the first few seconds to bring it to a halt. But I'm wondering, when is this type of behavior just normal and you should not yell, hey, hey, stop it?
Oh, it's a good question, and it's a fine line. It's a tricky one. But there are a couple things I can tell you that hopefully will be helpful. One is, it well might be normal. But normal isn't necessarily going to be a helpful category for you, you know? All kinds of things that aren't really so good are normal, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing to think about in terms of basically the dog park itself is that when other people's dogs are the receivers of your dog's behavior, they don't know your dog. They have no clue if your dog is going to kill them or not. And even if there are no injuries, other dogs can be terrified. So I'm glad you're asking, and I really appreciate you asking, because I would not let my dog do that. And that's not dominance, by the way. Dominance isn't aggression. Dominance is just having more social freedom than another individual. And so you can be dominant by sort of a military coup, you know, or you can be dominant like Gandhi, you know. You can be sort of a benevolent leader type. So there's some reason your dog is overreacting like that. He doesn't need to do that. He's got some social issues. So I would, if I were you, I would find somebody you could work with in your area, a behaviorist, a really good trainer, a veterinarian who's got a lot of experience with training and behavioral issues, and figure out why he's doing that, because it's not necessary. Shouldn't be necessary. And teach him a new way to interact. I've worked with a lot of dogs for 20 years. I've been helping people, and I had a dog like that myself. I actually have one I'm working on, and he's so much better to teach to greet appropriately. And I don't, you know, I can't do a how-to right now on the radio, but there are ways to do that. So you might want to go also on the internet and look for books. My book's called Feisty Fido. There's some really good books out there about how to teach dogs to greet appropriately.
So, okay, thanks very much.
Yeah, yeah, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, our number, if you'd like to join in. And someone has. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Thanks for taking my call. This is Michael in Oklahoma City.
Michael, thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a miniature horse, and I need to know if it would be best for him to have a companion.
Oh, it would. It absolutely would. Now, tell me a little bit about your horse. How old? What kind of social experience this little mini has had before?
Seamus is 9 years old and was gelded when he was one.
Okay.
And for the first 6 years, we had him in the backyard, about 2 acres, and he loved to run with our Boston Terriers.
What an image.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But we thought that he needed some companions. So what we did was we turned him over to a friend of ours who has, about 10 acres and 3 horses. The problem is the horses, through the pecking order, were really working on him. He knows how to open gates, and with our friends, he learned how to take it and step onto bottom wire of a fence and then scoot his body up underneath it.
Oh, gee.
And get out.
Oh, boy.
So he was wandering the neighborhood all the time. And with us, even with a strong metal can, trash can, for some reason, raccoon can't get in it, but Seamus can go ahead and nuzzle it and use his teeth and pop it open to get to food, too. So he's pretty intelligent.
Yeah, dumb is good sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So about his social companions, I'm glad you told me his history, because one of the issues we're dealing with here is a horse who didn't grow up with horses. You know, and horses are highly social. They have a lot to learn, just like dogs and people, about how to behave in social groups. What does it mean when another horse's ears goes back, et cetera, et cetera. But horses are highly social, so I very much think he should have a companion. You know, the trick with miniature horses, obviously, is that they're extremely small, and they can be quite ornery and full of themselves. They're sort of like terriers. They can be really full of themselves, but yet they're tiny. And so they can start things, but then they end up getting hurt because they're so small. What about a goat? Goats can be great companions for horses.
Oh, okay.
That's what I would think about. Goats are highly social. Mm. They're also, by the way, parenthetically, extremely smart, very good at getting out of things and into things. So you can quadruple your problems there and throw darts at pictures of Larry and I. But nonetheless, goats can be great. They're really
fun. They're easy to
care
for.
They can be great pets. They're relatively easy to care for, and they're great companions for small horses. So that's what I think about.
How would I keep the goat in the yard? I have a fence that is 4 wires. Will the goat be able to crawl underneath that and get out?
Are they electrified? They would have to be.
Yes. It would have to be, I suppose.
Yeah, it would. It really, really would. The one of the things about horses that's not intuitive is horses are the easiest animal to keep inside a fence. You can have one. You drive around in the country, there's one little tiny wire about 1.5 feet above the ground. And that's it. You know, you can keep 100 horses inside this big pasture with one little tiny wire. Goats, not so much.
Okay.
So that would be an issue. But it sounds like this horse can get out, too. That's
correct.
Really dangerous. And, you know, we don't want to think about lawsuits and yucky things happening. So I would improve your fencing and consider a goat.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, find out if healthy but aging humans experience the same changes in memory as certain animals do. I knew that once, but I forgot. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time now for this week's topic. And Tricia, it turns out that humans aren't the only ones in the animal kingdom that become forgetful with age.
That's right. A study done by Boutet and some others was recently published in the Journal of Comparative Psychology. They studied 30 people over the age of 65 and 30 adults under the age of 23. Now, all these tests done in the study were about memory.
Okay.
About memory in people and memory in animals. And what I love about these particular tests is that the tests that were used were actually developed for animals. They've been given to non-human primates and dogs, but in this case, they were administered to people. And usually it's the other way around.
Well, what did they tell the participants to do?
Well, here's the exact instructions that they were read. Here's a game, and your job is to find a nickel hidden under an object. I'm going to show you either one object or two objects. If I show you one object, simply pick up the nickel underneath it. If I show you two objects, you'll find a nickel underneath only one of them. Try to find the nickel every time the tray is presented to you. What they weren't told was that when there were two objects visible, the nickel was always under the one that was different than the single object they'd just seen. So let me give you an example. If first they were shown an apple, and that was taken away, and then next they were shown an apple and a banana, the nickel would always be under the banana, the thing that was different than what they'd first seen. So they had to remember the first object that they'd seen, and it could have been 20 seconds or 30 seconds or 40 seconds ago.
And how did they do? Did the older folks do as well as the younger ones?
No. Darn it, they did not. Boo, yes, they did not. Older people did not do as well as younger ones. But in our defense, speaking as not quite over 65, but getting there, the differences were significant. But, Larry, they were still relatively small.
You know, as an older adult,
yes.
Not quite 65 yet, but older anyway, I would have been trying to second guess all the time. I would have thought, okay, they had it under the banana the first time, so they're going to put it under the apple this time.
So
I would have remembered that it was under the apple the first time or under, you know, whatever.
Right, right. Well, you know,
I would have been trying to second guess.
Well, would you? Here's the question, though. Would you have been trying to second guess equally when you were younger as when you're older? But when you first do this, you don't know why the nickel is under what. It takes a while to figure out the pattern there. So I'll just have to give you this test sometime. Hopefully your memory will be so bad that you'll forget about it, and then we can give you the test.
Well, what I want to know is, what can we learn from this study?
I don't know. I forgot. I don't know. No, here's some of the things we know. This kind of study, which also was done, by the way, on young and older primates and young and older dogs, is that it seems as though in some particular types of context, our brains seem to age in similar ways as the brains of other primates and dogs. Because they also, with this particular task, showed age-related, quote, deficits in memory. But, you know, we also know, an encouraging fact is, we also know from other research that even though as we age, our brains can get a little fuzzier, we can alleviate that by exercising them. So keep looking for the nickel under the banana. That's all I have to say.
And maybe you'll find a nickel under the telephone when you pick it up to dial 1-800-462-7413. How's that? I tell you what, we've got lots of callers online. Let's go to the phones. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Eileen, and I'm calling from Dallas, Texas.
Hi, Eileen. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
We'll be sending you a nickel in the mail.
All right. I'll take it. I have a 22-year-old kitty who is having trouble using the litter box. And I know it's not a urinary tract infection. She had her at the vet and had that checked. But she will go in the proximity of the litter box, and what I think is that she forgets to turn around. She puts her front two paws in and then doesn't always remember to turn to use it accurately. Sometimes she does and sometimes she doesn't.
That is very possible. Most quadrupeds, dogs, cats, horses, do not consciously think about where their back feet are. And if you think about it, they pretty much get away with that because their back feet pretty much follow their front ones. But when you're doing exercises with horses or you're doing agility with a dog, you actually have to teach them to concentrate on where their back paws are. And as animals get older, they seem to lose a lot of the feedback from their hindquarters. And a 22-year-old cat is an old kitty.
So that's just a sweetie.
That's one possibility. Yeah, and how good you are to keep her going for so long and how lucky you are. I would consider, just because she's so old, just putting newspaper down around a litter box. But, you know, there is another hypothesis, which is that it hurts her hindquarters to get inside the box. So if you could put a little step up so it was easier for her to get into the box. Some older cats, just it's uncomfortable for them to get into the box. So
okay.
you might try a little step up. I know some people have cut a little entryway, a little doorway, that means that the there's still a lip, obviously, that keeps the litter in, but the cat doesn't have to step up with their hindquarters so much to get in. So that's the other possibility you might want to think about.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very, very much. And, you know, we had a pet tip that kind of relates to this. A listener named Giselle sent us a pet tip some time ago about what she did when her mom's 20-year-old cat could get into the litter box but could never seem to aim quite right when going to the bathroom.
Okay.
Giselle's solution is to use cloth bed incontinent pads instead. They're waterproof on the backside and they're washable. To get your cat to begin using the pads instead of the litter box, put the pads in the same spot the litter box used to be and sprinkle a handful of litter.
Absolutely.
On the pad. Gradually reduce the amount of litter you put in the pad over the span of a week or two. The pads are easy to clean up. And to wash them, you just toss them into the washing machine with hot water, detergent, and white vinegar.
That's a great idea. That's a wonderful idea. I don't know if I'd use vinegar. I'd probably use a neutralizer. But that's a super idea. And I love the way she talked about putting the pad in the litter box and slowly, gradually getting the cat used to it. You know, we could buy stock in Depends here.
If somebody wants to send us a pet tip, how do they do it?
Oh, we love to hear from you. Send us a tip to pets@wpr.org, or you can go on the website and send an email through that.
And you can call us at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name's Michelle. I'm calling from Southwest Florida. I have a question about my Jack Russell Terrier. She is 9 months old, and she's got what I'm calling a bit of a flight response. We have 5 acres, and we have a small front yard that we like to let her go out in. We've found that we've had to leash her because if we don't, she'll look at you, know you want to get her, and just darts the other direction. You're so patient at first because they're babies and you bring them home, and then it does become very irritating. And for her safety, we need to get her inside.
Absolutely. Here's the bottom line with this, is that for a certain amount of time, you have to prevent animals from being able to just dash away and run around the countryside or run around their 5 acres and not come in, because the payoff is so good. You know, it's so much fun to sniff around and smell rabbits and lizards and, you know, and they love it when we start wanting to chase them. Ooh, boy, I got to chase. That's one of their favorite ways of play. Is as you watch dogs play, they play chase games, you know. So
sure.
You start chasing your terrier, she's like, hee-hee, we're playing now.
You know? I've ended up with a bloody knee
her. And so that the first thing I want you to do is eliminate that from your repertoire. Don't even lean forward when you want to get her. Believe it or not, I want you to do the opposite. What I want you to do is do put her on a long line, because there is a safety issue here. But what I want you to start doing is I want you to start a game. And the game is going to involve great treats or ball or some kind of toy. She loves to chase toys. But you're going to go outside. She's going to be on a long line that she can just drag around. But what you're going to do is you're going to not go towards her. You're going to look sort of sideways. You're going to turn sort of sideways. And you're going to...
Okay.
What's her name?
Bandy.
Bandy. And what have you used to call her to come so far?
Just myself. Bandy, come.
Okay, so we're not going to say come anymore.
Okay.
Because she's learned. Right? She's learned.
Okay.
That means go.
That means go. Go, go, go. So you could say, Bandy, go. Or you could say something that's not like come. You could say, here, here.
Okay.
You know? You could say that'll do. Pretend she's a herding dog.
Okay.
So what I want you to do is I want you to look at her, and you're going to say, Bandy, that'll do. And then you're going to clap, and you're going to start running the other way, going, hoo-hoo, hee-hee, hoo-hoo. And she's going to chase you.
Okay.
And you say, good girl, good girl, good girl. And then you stop, and you turn around just part way. Don't try and grab her. You're going to throw her a little piece of food. Drop a little piece of food in between you and her. And let her eat it, and then you're going to go, Bandy, that'll do. And you're going to run the other way, and she's going to chase you. That's really fun. Do that like 3-4 times.
Okay.
And then you're very quietly going to move towards, while she's eating, you know, you're going to move towards the end of this line. You're going to pick it up, and you're going to say, okay, let's go inside. You can take her inside.
Okay.
And I want you to basically create this game so you classically condition her to run to you when you say, Bandy, that'll do.
Okay. Okay, and I like that. I think I'll use that'll do. I like that.
It's sort of fun to say. That'll do.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. That'll do.
It just works, doesn't it?
It does.
That'll do.
Here's a number that works, 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll pay tribute to a special African gray parrot whose remarkable intellect made the world reconsider the definition of bird brain. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Irene Pepperberg to the program. Irene is a lecturer and research associate at Harvard University. She's an adjunct associate professor at Brandeis University in Massachusetts as well, and she's well known for her work with Alex, one of the most famous African gray parrots. Alex passed away on September 6th of 2007, and Irene joins us today to share his story with us. And Irene, welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us today, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you for having me here.
What was the original purpose of your research with Alex?
We wanted to see how intelligent these birds could be and whether they could develop some kind of two-way communication. The time I began the work, everybody was talking about language studies with apes, and nobody had thought to work with a bird that could actually talk. So this was supposed to be a breakthrough in using a different species.
And Alex had an amazing vocabulary, and you used something called the model rival system to teach him words. What's that model rival system?
It's a lovely procedure first developed by my German colleague Dietmar Toth, who was an ethologist looking at how birds would likely learn in the wild from observing their peers. And in the system, we have the student, a parrot, or even a child, and a trainer, and then one person who is the model for the bird's behavior and its rival for the trainer's attention. And we start with an object that the bird really, really wants, and we train the label for that object, and that object is going to be the reward. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the object and the label. So then let's say I start out as the trainer and I show it to the model rival and I ask, you know, what's this? And she'll say key. And I'll go, that's right, it's a key. And I hand it over. So the bird sees that this weird noise has mediated transfer of the object. And now she has the key and she's scratching under her chin the way the bird would and going, key, key, I've got the key, it's a key. And after a bit, we exchange roles of model rival and trainer. So the bird sees that one person is not always the questioner and the other the respondent, but it's an interactive process. And then she shows it to me and says, what's this? And I go, all right. And she turns away and says, no. So the bird sees that not any weird noise, transfers the object. And I get another chance, and I say key, and I get it again. And we go back and forth a few times, and then we ask the bird. The bird is not going to say key right off, but he may say something like ee, okay? A new sound, somewhat like what we want. and we'll reward that initially, give him the key, and, you know, key, you've got the key, the same type of thing, and then eventually we'll shape it up into a clear vocalization.
If I recall correctly, you use this model rival system because there had been previous attempts using a very kind of Skinner box-like kind of work, you know, very sort of standard operant conditioning kind of work to teach parrots to use words that was unsuccessful, right?
That's correct. That was the work of people like Maurer in the 40s and 50s. And also people, Grosslein and Zehner tried using tapes with birds, minor birds, in sound isolation boxes, just playing them the tapes. And the funny thing there was the birds were mimicking the sounds of the people coming in and out of the room and the doors closing, but nothing on the tapes.
That's great.
So those were smart birds.
Right. Well, the point is, communication is a social act. You know, and I mean, to do it in any other way, to train it in any way that isn't social, just doesn't make sense.
But Alex's intelligence stood out above all the others that you've worked with, I think. Why was that the case, do you think?
Alex had a very special life. For his first 15 years, he was an only bird. And so everything was focused on him. I mean, at least eight hours a day, somebody was there with him, talking to him, not always training, but always talking with him, interacting with him, responding to his requests. The other birds, first of all, we were trying to look at other possible training techniques with the other birds just to make sure that our modeling system was the most efficient one. So they had many, many years of essentially inefficient, useless training using videotapes and audio tapes. Yeah. And then second, Alex, once we, you know, moved back east, Alex was interrupting all of their sessions. So, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, we'd be trying to work on colors with Griffin. And Alex would sit there and say, no, you tell me what shape. And Griffin would look at me and look at Alex and do a little parrot kind of shoulder shrug and wing shrug and go, mm-hmm.
So, Irene, tell us about all the things that Alex learned.
Oh, he learned to identify about labels for about 50 different objects, 7 colors, 5 shapes, quantities up to including 6. We had just gotten data on 7 and 8 before he died. He combined these labels to identify, request, refuse, and categorize about 100 things in the lab. He used phrases like, I want X and want to go Y, where X and Y are appropriate object or location labels. You could ask him to a limited extent about things that weren't physically present. So he could tell you that, you know, yellow was the color of corn, even if there wasn't any corn. His requests were intentional. If he asked for a grape and you gave him a banana, you know, he'd throw the banana at you. And, I mean, basically he could understand how to use these labels to manipulate people and to get what he wanted.
You know, you sent us some recordings of Alex being asked some questions about what something is. Somebody actually, in the first one, is going to hold a popsicle stick up to Alex's face and ask, what matter is that?
Okay. What matter is that?
Let's hear it again.
Let's hear it again.
Okay. What matter is that?
It's wood. And then there's another one in which I think, Irene, you're actually holding up a small orange cup, and you ask about the color. Let's listen to that one.
What color?
Orange.
Really good.
There's a funny story there. We did an interview, a live radio interview for BBC a number of years ago, and I was trying to get him to identify the color of this thing. So I go and I ask what color, and he says, no, tell me what matter. So I say, well, it's wood. Now, can you tell me what color? His, what shape? Alex, okay, it's 4-corner. You know, what color? You know, and then he says, how many? I said, there's 1 toy. Now, can you please tell me what color? And, you know.
That's great.
You know, one of the criticisms of some of your early work was that you hadn't accounted for the Clever-Hans effect. Tell us what the Clever-Hans effect is and why it applies to Alex's performance.
Well, Hans was a horse in Germany, and he supposedly did these incredible feats of addition and subtraction and things. And what he did was he'd tap his hoof, and when he reached the right answer, like, you know, 17 plus 32 and whatever it was, you know, he stopped tapping. And everybody was just amazed. Finally, Otto Funkst found out that what the clever Hans was really quite clever, but he was clever at watching people. And he would wait till he'd sense a slight relaxation on the part of the person watching him, and then he would stop tapping. Now, clearly, a sequential tapping thing that you wait for one type of cue is very different from the kinds of things we were doing with Alex. And again, working in the vocal mode right away, you avoid so much of this. I mean, even if I was going guh to him, you know, there's green, gray, grape, grain, yeah. You know, and cook, carrot, cork, corn, and you know, things like that. But we were very careful when we did formal training and testing so that anybody who did training did not get involved in the testing, so he couldn't have picked up a particular cue from a person. Another student would ask him the questions. I'd have my back to him, and I would repeat what I heard him say. And if that was right, he'd get rewarded, otherwise not. Because if he said something like, and I couldn't tell if it was green or three, you know, that was an issue, and he'd have to say better.
I wanted to hear some more of Alex, and we have another recording, I should say, of Alex saying, "I'm sorry." And can we hear that one?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Oh, Irene, that reminds me of a story, a touching story you tell about the first time you had to leave Alex at a vet clinic.
Yes, he had aspergillosis. We had been trying to take care of him in the lab, and it just wasn't working, trying to medicate him and do all the things we needed to do. So we brought him in, and I'm walking out the door. And the evening, whenever I would leave, there was a goodnight routine. You know, you be good, I'll see you tomorrow, things like that. But this one was very different. He looks at me in this pitiful little voice, says, "I'm sorry, want to go back."
No.
Obviously did not want me to leave him there, and trying to explain to him that I'll see you tomorrow, it's okay, it's a normal good night, was really, really tough.
Well, Alex was 31 years old when he died, and that's young for an African gray. Do you know the cause of death, by the way?
It was heart arrhythmia. He had some arteriosclerosis, and his heart went into an arrhythmia, and he just went. The vet told me that even if I had been there when it happened, there was nothing I could have done.
That must have helped.
I mean, it helps a little bit, but, you know.
Not enough.
Not enough. That's right.
Well, you know, maybe what does help some is thinking about how your research with Alex has left this legacy. I'd love to hear you talk about the legacy that Alex's work has left for humans as well as for parrots.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, first of all, for in terms of humans, we have been continuing to work on adapting this model arrival technique for use with autistic children, with children with other disabilities. And my colleague in California, Diane Sherman, she and I have published two papers on this. We're working on a third, showing people how this can help these children understand the whole communication system and the social system that goes along with it. In terms of what people think about birds, I mean, I think that's why Alex had such a great impact, because he showed them that, I mean, I joke about it, but I say that being a bird brain is actually a compliment. I mean, after he died, it was the most amazing response. I mean, I knew there would be some publicity, but I did not expect that the story on him would be the most emailed New York Times article on September 11th.
Oh.
With all the import of that day. There were three articles, actually, in the New York Times. First, his little obituary, then a lovely letter to the editor, and then a News in the Week in Review. It was in the Manchester Guardian. He had an obituary in The Economist. I don't know if he's been the only animal, but I think, you know,
Probably the only parrot.
Yeah.
You have two other African gray parrots in your lab named Wart and Griffin. Do you believe you'll be able to have as much success with them as you did with Alex?
Wart, a.k.a. Arthur, I don't know. He's kind of a party animal. he really likes to sit there and play with his toys, and I don't think he really understands why he needs to learn how to talk. Griffin is very, very smart. He was doing a number of really exciting things when we were still in Arizona, and he had his own room where he could be trained apart from Alex. He did learn some things from Alex. We're hoping that he will sort of step into those, you know, claw marks and carry on.
Well, we are sorry for your loss. Thank you so much for being with us today, Irene. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Irene Pepperberg is a lecturer and research associate at Harvard University and adjunct associate professor at Brandeis University, and she joined us today from the Harvard News office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call. The number is 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of For the Love of a Dog by our own Patricia McConnell. And here's today's question. As we mentioned during the interview with Irene Pepperberg, Alex died at 31 years of age, which is young for an African gray parrot. What is the average life expectancy of an African gray parrot? If you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the correct answer, check our website. In about a week, we'll have it posted online at callingallpets.org. And if you'd like to join in, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Jackie from Huntington, New York.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, we have a Portuguese water dog who is an absolutely wonderful dog. She's 8 months old. She was very easy to train in every way except one.
Uh-oh.
Well, two, actually. She tends to take things and run with them, but she's kind of stopped that. But she eats everything.
Mm.
Weeds. If she finds a paper clip on the floor, that goes in her mouth. No matter what it is, it's in her mouth, and it's really hard to control, especially if she's outside with berries and stuff, and we want to see if we can curb that or get her out of that habit.
I'm wondering if it seems almost obsessive. You know, with this kind of behavioral problem, there's a kind of a continuum where you can see it at such extremity that it actually starts looking and acting like obsessive-compulsive disorder. And at the other end of the continuum, you can see dogs who just sort of do it problematically, and, you know, puppies. And so what, on a 0 to 10, just from your intuitive sense, how obsessive is this? How extreme does this seem to you?
I would say midway, about 5.
Okay.
She's also very food-oriented.
Is she?
She will do anything for the tiniest piece of kibble.
Well, so, that's good.
So for that reason, she was really, like, super easy to train. Besides, she's a very smart dog. So I'd say this is about halfway.
Okay. Well, given that, what I would suggest you do is a couple things. One, teach her a cue that allows you to, with a quiet word, to stop her and turn her head around over towards you. And it's actually relatively easy to do. I want you to teach her leave it. And what you're going to do is you're going to take a dry biscuit, you know, like just sort of plain old doggy biscuit, and you're going to put that in your fist, and you're going to offer it right to her nose. And as you move your hand towards her nose, you're going to say, leave it.
We've done that. We've done that, and she's great with that. She
good.
Backs up. She sits down.
Good.
I put things on the floor. I say, leave it. She leaves it.
Okay.
It's the stuff she finds, like somebody drops a paper napkin that's right in her mouth. It's stuff she finds before you see her grab it.
Gotcha. Mm. I think if she was my dog, I'd do a couple things. I would carefully look at her diet and how much fiber there is in it. I would try feeding her multiple times during the day, since she seems so oral. And I would look to see, you know, what is she getting in there? I don't know how many adjunctive medicine practitioners you have around you, but my tendency would be to talk carefully with my veterinarian, make sure there's nothing going on that he or she can find, and then maybe even think about, you know, some kind of adjunctive medicine to see if there's something else going on.
What would that be?
Well, either homeopathic or Chinese medicine, for example.
Okay. There are veterinarians.
There are. My dogs have a veterinary acupuncturist. And it's been extremely helpful for digestive issues with my Great Pyrenees. Obviously, that's after lots and lots of work with my vet, with actually five veterinarians.
Oh, wow.
But the other thing I do is I would exercise this dog, and I know this is easy for me to say. I would exercise this dog. I would find all kinds of ways of exercising both her body and her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also try and see if you can create a humane consequence for doing something like gobbling a paperclip. If you start to see her do it, I would try tossing something across the room that lands right at her feet that doesn't terrify her but startles her so she stops doing it. And don't say anything because, you know, basically you want this to sort of fall from the sky.
Hmm.
Okay?
Something.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been very helpful.
Oh, good.
Thanks, Jackie, for calling. Appreciate it. Patricia, we received an interesting email from Helga in Bethesda, Maryland, and this was very interesting. She wants to know the following. How can I overcome my fear of cats? My daughter is going to have a baby soon, and I'll need to be with her in her house. She has one cat, and her partner will be bringing two more cats into the home real soon. I listen to your program every weekend, but nobody seems to be afraid of cats or pets. Can you give me some tips on how to handle this situation? Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you're right. You don't hear a lot of people who are afraid of cats. It's more common for people to be afraid of dogs. But phobias are phobias, you know.
Yep.
They are what they are. So I think the best advice that I can give you is I would find a psychologist who specializes in this. There are psychologists who do this. This is what they specialize in.
Mm-hmm.
They use desensitization. I would also think that counterconditioning would be incredibly helpful. That's what we use with non-human animals. It's extremely effective. It changes your basic emotional response to something. So desensitizing starts basically with, looking at a picture of a cat across the room and just doing that over and over and over and over and over again, just getting used to having just a photograph of a mm-hmm. cat in one room and maybe having one room with several photographs and then getting closer and closer to the photograph and then looking at a cat far away that has a screen door, you know, between you. That's desensitizing. Counterconditioning sort of ups the ante by pairing something that you love, that you have a positive emotional response to, with a low-level intensity of the cat stimulus. So rather than just having a picture of a cat in the room, you look at the cat and then you'd eat a chocolate chip. This would be me. You know, maybe not good for a diet, but that's what I do. So cat, chocolate chip, cat, chocolate chip, or cat, neck rub. You know, cat, neck rub. Somebody could, you know, help you out here a little bit. So basically you're pairing a good emotion with the thing that used to make you fearful. So the trick is to go slowly. And if it's a really serious phobia, I strongly suggest that you work with a psychologist because there are people who are really, really good at this and can get people over really serious phobias.
And you kind of wonder how these things develop, you know, and it's serious. You know, I couldn't imagine being afraid of a cat, but people are afraid of things like cats.
Phobias are so interesting because they seem relatively illogical, although there's good research on them that shows that phobias are usually about things that can be dangerous. Spiders, snakes, heights, and cat. Let me tell you, somebody who works with aggressive animals, there's nothing scarier than I should. Don't listen, listener. But you know, it's not unreasonable. Cats are predators. It's not unreasonable to be afraid. But these phobias do seem to come out of nowhere.
And if people want to email us or go to our website, they can do all that, can't they?
Oh, we love it. Our website is callingallpets.org, easy to go to. And just send us an email as well to pets@wpr.org.
And call us at 1-800-462-7413. And someone has done just that. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Cindy from Fort Worth, Texas.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I have what I think is kind of a strange question. My son has a rather large dog. He's about 3 years old, and I have a medium-sized dog. She's 11. And when my son's dog walks into the house from outside, my dog, the smaller dog, gets right in his ear and barks. I mean, it's not like they're equal size. She has to stretch up to do it, and she does it every single time. She's not biting him. She's not aggressive towards him. She just gets right in his ear and barks.
And so she's not just barking in front of him. She's targeting his ear, right?
Yes.
That's really funny.
She's on the side of him, right in his ear.
What does he do when she does this?
He just kind of looks at her and moves. And
there she goes again.
And she, yeah, pretty much. I mean, he's very good-natured. And, you know, there's never been an aggression between them. There's a lot of wagging tails. And
that's good.
So I just think it's odd, and I really want to know what's going through her head.
Well, one possibility that isn't quite as bemusing but it also speaks very highly of her, is that she's, for whatever reason, she's barking at him. She wants him to play with her. She didn't want him to walk in the room the way he did. She's reminding him that even though you're really big, this is my house. I mean, there are all kinds of messages that could be there. Barks are sort of like smiles. They can be friendly. They can be not so friendly. So I don't know exactly what her message is, but it might be that she's on the side, because if she was directly in front of him staring straight at him, that would be very polite in our society, but it's very rude in canine society. And so by being on the side, she's diffusing tension. She would actually be creating. She would be being socially inappropriate if she was meeting him head on. So by going to the side but still barking at his head, it sort of makes it look like she's barking right into his ear. And a lot of times you do see this sort of barking or directed behavior, sort of licking or, you know, muzzle jabbing is often directed towards the head. So she's directing it towards the head but not in an offensive, potentially aggressive way. But then again, you know, maybe she studied anatomy and she's like, I'm going to bark in the place where my bark is most relevant. Maybe they know what ears do. Who knows?
And some people have said that she's a female and he's a male, so it's just what females do.
Listen to me. Did you hear me? I said.
Oh, thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Patricia, thank you. We'll be back next week and do this again, I hope.
I promise not to bark in your ear too loudly, Larry.
Thank you. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to bring out the best in your pet. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0112P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.